The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, Spurs top after a comprehensive win in the North London derby despite not having the ball for the whole game. The cheat code that is Kane to Son undoes Arsenal. How do you defend against it? Liverpool swap Wolves aside with ominous ease. It's a game of two halves again for Manchester United, but what tactical genius from Solskjaer to put his best player on the pitch. Lampard outwits Bielsa, Vardy two-foots a corner flag, and Benteke is back. We'll discuss the depressing scenes at the New Den as fans booed the Millwall and Derby players taking the knee. There's a Premier League bailout for the EFL, a player booked for scoring a goal in Germany. Your questions, Ohiogate continues, as does the search for Carly Rae Jepsen. All on today's Guardian Football Weekly. Now, before introducing the panel, you can probably hear me in crystal clear quality right now. That isn't going to last very long. Something happened with my recording device. I really don't think I'm that incompetent, but at the moment, it almost appears that I'm more incompetent than Barry. And that's the bar I set myself, and it's very humiliating for me to fall below it. Jamie, Jonathan, and Barry all sound good for all the podcast. I sound good in part three. Hope you enjoy it.
On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson. Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good. Thanks for asking. Jamie Jackson, nice to see you. You all right?
Never been better, thank you, Max.
Excellent news. Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Nice to see you.
Hello.
All right, should we start then at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium? Spurs 2, Arsenal 0. 7 points from 9 for Spurs against City, Chelsea and Arsenal, conceding no goals. Could you have scripted a more classic Jose Spurs win than that? Early goal, Kane to Son. Sit back, soak up the pressure, get one in first half injury time, Son to Kane, and then have no shots in the second half. Jonathan?
Yeah, it's classic Mourinho. I mean, this is what he did in his first season at Chelsea. 2-0 was his favourite scoreline. I thought Spurs were really, really good, playing a sort of football we haven't really seen for a long, long time. Well, I mean, we've seen it from Tottenham this season, but before that. I mean, I don't know what happens when Son or Kane stops being brilliant, which you assume must happen at some point, being this level of brilliant. But for now, it's working very, very well.
And is it just football coming full circle to this point? What does it mean in tactical terms?
Well, I think there has been, you know, the uber high press that has characterised elite level football the last 3 or 4 years has regressed because of the circumstances. It's not possible, both physically and in terms of doing the preparation work. So I think it is a slightly more old-fashioned form of football. Football's come back to Jose. Jose hasn't moved. Football's come back to him. But I think you saw that even the way Liverpool have been playing recently. They're not playing with the same sort of relentlessness that they have done over the previous couple of seasons. When football becomes very attritional, as it is at the moment, the person who's best at digging trenches wins, and that's Jose.
Barry, have you just downed a raw egg smoothie in front of us all?
It was like a third of a pint.
Okay, all right.
I'm really glad that you did that, because I just saw Max's face kind of sort of coil in horror, and I was like, "What have I said? What have I done?"
Well, I mean, it's
how many eggs?
Two. But I mean, there's a load of strawberries and a banana in there as well. If there was no eggs there, it would still look the same.
Okay, well, that's fine. A cul-de-sac for you, Barry. How good was Son's goal?
Very good indeed, and almost monotonous in its predictability. We all knew what he was going to do. Rob Holding, I think it was, ushered him inside. Very chivalrous of him. And it was a absolutely delightful finish. And Son, it's kind of like his signature move now. Everyone knows he's going to do it. No one can stop him. But Arsenal didn't really even try to stop it. So
yeah, I guess he can do both. He can go onto his left.
Oh, I mean, there's every chance he would have either set up a goal for Kane or scored anyway. But at least try and make it a bit difficult for him. But, you know, the finish took what was inch perfect. I don't think you could blame Bernd Leno for it. And it was a wonderful goal. And he is a wonderful player. And I keep being reminded, I think it was when Lucas Moura came to Spurs, everyone thought that was the end of the road for Son, that they were going to sell him on, and there was talk of him going to Stuttgart or somewhere, I can't remember, but what a mistake that would have been to sell him.
Absolutely. You say he's a wonderful player, Jamie. I'm trying to work out if, you know, do we elevate him yet to the top table of footballers? What table's he sitting on?
He's probably, it depends what you mean by the top table, because obviously you've got the old guard, and then you've got, I don't think he's quite Mbappe, who's sort of the new guard, but I think then if you go to a strata or a table, you know, sort of, if you're at a wedding, he's at a sort of a middle table. He's not right at the front by the groom. And it's interesting because we try to think, why is Jose doing this at Spurs? He couldn't do it at United. My own little theory is he's got a better squad, which I know sounds obvious. So he came second that year with United, 81 points, which is quite a lot. It was 19 behind the 100-point City. If you look at that squad that he had, people like Chris Smalling in it, no disrespect, of course, you know, it wasn't really the same level overall generally than the Spurs one is. So it's interesting what Jonathan says about football coming back to Jose. I just wonder what Jose Mourinho might have done with this squad, you know, let's say 2 years ago against the sort of the rampant City, then the Liverpool, obviously coming up on the rails. I think they're probably going to win it this year. I think he knows, obviously, he knows completely what he's doing. And yeah, okay, one of those two get injured. But the other one that interests me is this the end completely 100% for Ali? Because he's gone from being sort of, you know, England's number 10 at the World Cup to, I don't know really, peripheral at best. And it's interesting because I always thought he was the sort of player you'd need to win a title. But as usual, Mourinho has his own ideas. And, you know, he's been proved right. It's very interesting what's going on this, because I really thought he was a busted flush. But what do I know?
Yeah, I certainly did. And can't delete those articles that have been printed. We've spoken about Harry Kane's assists before, 10 already this season in 11 games. Rob McNichol tweets, cliche machine Jamie Redknapp says Harry Kane is worth his weight in gold. If Kane weighs 90 kilograms, at a current gold per kilo rate of approximately $60,000, he's worth $5.4 million, which at the current exchange rate is just over £4 million. I reckon there may be some takers for Harry Kane in January if he's on the market for his weight in gold. On their relationship, you know, it's only Shearer and Sutton and Ryan Fraser and Callum Wilson who have scored more goals combined in an entire Premier League season. And it's only December. And it isn't really December because the season started late. Jonathan, the break for the second, right? Who do you, from the Arsenal perspective, obviously Thomas Partey limping off is not ideal. But who is it for? How do you stop that? Because it looks like four Arsenal players just run towards, I'm not sure who plays the pass. Is it Aurier to Lo Celso? Which means they're just so overrun, even if Partey was not injured.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a failure of organisation and also a failure of wit that somehow some message should have been communicated that Partey was injured. Because you could see he was, you know, when he tried to get back, he couldn't actually make the run. He sort of staggered sort of 10 yards or so, then had to pull up. So you can't really blame him. And maybe he should have gone down and sort of forced the issue. And so somebody could have put the ball out or could have at least shouted that the ball needs to be put out. But then, yeah, the organisation. And you think when you're playing Tottenham, what's the one thing you practice defending against breaks involving Kane and Son? It's the they just keep doing it. I mean, is that 11 assists between each other this season?
Yeah.
And the all-time record in the Premier League, not just for one season, but in a career, is 36 between Lampard and Drogba. So in, what, not even a third of a season, they're a third of the way to the all-time record. And this is not normal in any sense. And the fact that Arsenal can't, yes, you know, seem so totally incapable of stopping that, I think is deeply worrying. And I find Arsenal really weird because end of last season, I thought, you know, when they were incredibly impressive, I thought, beating City in the Cup semi-final and Chelsea in the Cup final, beat Liverpool at home, even the Community Shield, you know, they held their own against Liverpool to win on penalties. And I sort of thought, yeah, the squad isn't great, so they're not going to mount a title challenge, but I can see the direction they're heading in. And I sort of just, you know, sometimes in this job you get spells where you just don't watch a team live for a month or so. And so I saw their results weren't good, but I wasn't really bothered by it. I just thought, ah, it's one of those things. And then I watched them against Leeds and thought, God, they're crap. Then I watched them against Wolves and thought, hang on, this is this isn't just sort of being overwhelmed by Bielsa's side. This is like really, really bad. And what annoys me about it is that after the West Ham game, I wrote a piece for the paper when I looked at their pressing stats, and I had this preconceived idea that their pressing had improved dramatically under Arteta. And the stats don't bear that out at all. It's actually slightly worse than they were under Emery for pressing. And so rather than writing that, which would have been correct and prescient, what I wrote was, well, Arteta, something about his personality means they still get results despite the fact that pressing isn't actually all that. But now it turns out their pressing was never all that, and they're actually just hopeless.
Michael says, were we wrong for thinking Arteta was a better standard of manager than Lampard and Ole? I mean, Jamie, there is this idea, lots was written about the fact that he'd just been near Pep Guardiola, that by osmosis, he would be brilliant.
Well, this is what I was going to say, because I think what we're seeing is how different it is to be a manager than it is to be a sort of a very astute number two who's not sort of having to deal with everything that comes at you, especially obviously at a club like Arsenal, which, you know, is one of our higher status clubs, most higher profile. You know, is this part of the sort of the darkest point before the dawn kind of thing for this season for him? Is he going to come through this and, you know, he almost has to go through this to sort of sort out some problems? I don't know. It's interesting. I heard someone say they were there. Well, he's bought some time because he won the FA Cup. And to a certain extent, of course he has, because, you know, you win a trophy basically in his first half a season, whatever it was, then he deserves that time. I mean, this whole thing about players going straight in, or ex-players, sorry, going straight into a very, you know, high-profile job, a bit like that, obviously, Lampard's done. I know Derby wasn't there too long. It's always interesting. It sometimes works, but I don't know what the stats are, but it's always, for me, a little bit iffy, because you're going to experience knocks. When you experience knocks, as I say, a very high-profile club, the sort of stakes are so much higher with regard to your own job, really. So I just don't know. I don't see loads of Arsenal, but, you know, they were impressive beating Manchester City in that semi-final, for example. But that's old news now. It could go either way. He's just starting to look a little bit haunted, Arteta, I think, which obviously you would be. I don't know. I'm not too sure he's going to survive.
Harry, we've talked about it before, but Harry Kane did another one of those backing in fouls.
Spear,
was penalised. The spear, yeah. And he should stop doing it. I mean, however well he's playing.
Sure, that's the third time he's been caught blatantly this season. Each one of them should be a straight red card and a 3-match ban. And someone is going to break their neck on the back of that, at which point he will claim it's a horrible accident. And it's coming. It is coming. Someone is going to get seriously hurt. As a result of him doing that. And unless referees start giving him red cards instead of free kicks, I'm genuinely concerned that someone is going to end up in a wheelchair because of him doing that. Is it worth it to win a free kick at the edge of the box? I don't think so, but...
Jonathan, perhaps less importantly, how big a suspension should you get for a foul throw? Hector Bellerin has done a lot of them.
Well... he's done 5, hasn't he? I think there's been 36 given in the Premier League this season. Well, there might have been some given late yesterday, I suppose. And I don't think there were. So I think he's done 30. I think he's done 5 of the 36 given in the Premier League this season. I mean, I've got sort of two slightly conflicting thoughts on this. Number one, you're professional footballer, learn how to do it. Number two, why the throw-in is weird, right? Why do we return the ball to the pitch like that? I understand that. You know, in 150 years ago, the law had to be changed because I can't remember his name, but there was a fullback who also played cricket, who was very good at throwing the ball one-handed. So he would literally be hurling the ball in the box from inside his own half. And clearly that's not conducive. Well,
sounds good to me.
That's not conducive to what we pretend we want to see on a football pitch. But I'm slightly with Arsene Wenger on this. I think the throw-in's just an odd thing. And because the player throwing it in, even if you're good, you throw it in to somebody who knocks it back to you, that moment of control is still quite difficult. There's three quite difficult things have to happen for the player throwing it in to get the ball back to cross it or play a pass on. So I'd be in favour of saying, essentially doing what you do in hockey, but the ball goes out of play. If it's your throw... You tap it on the line and then you can just go. And no opposition player can be within 5 yards of you, whatever. And yeah, I guess people would start taking them a bit like corners, but maybe you could have some sort of regulation where you can't play it more than, if you want to take it to your, you know, if you're going to kick it, you can't take it more than 3 yards or something.
Well, in Gaelic football, you can kick it as far as you like. What's wrong with that? You can kick it into the penalty.
I mean, I'm not really sure football needs to be learning from a sport like
well,
that.
Well, that is a fair point.
Wilson. Yeah. I mean, any amateur football will tell you the hardest skill in football is a cushioned volley back to the thrower when you boot it 40 yards out of play and then just jog back. Right, let's go to Anfield. Liverpool 4, Wolves 0. Melvin says, how many players missing will it require for Liverpool to be rubbish? They look ominously good, don't they? Since Liverpool's first game after Van Dijk's injury against Everton, they've let in just 6 in 11, kept 6 clean sheets in the process. Matip and Fabinho are looking very tight at the back. Joachim says, is Kelleher now the greatest Irish thing to enter England since Barry?
Well, it, not so great that the kit man was able to spell his surname correctly on the back of his shirt, which had to be...
And that's not even the hard one.
Yeah, which had to be changed at halftime. I mean, it was a good performance. He made two pretty good saves. I do think there's been a slight overreaction to how brilliant he is. It was an okay performance. He didn't do anything wrong. I've certainly seen more outstanding goalkeeping performances, but then he wasn't given a huge amount to do. He seems perfectly good goalkeeper, which is not a huge surprise because that's his job. He's not some bloke they've pulled off the street, like handed a pair of gloves to.
Jamie, how happy do you think Connor Cody was that fans stadium to watch you know, his beloved Liverpool and watch him assist Liverpool's opener and then dive for
yes.
the penalty. That brilliant thing where Henderson went, come on, mate,
and Cody just
went, hit down and run back.
Well, every time I saw the sort of the chest control that led to their goal, you know, the mistake from him, I just thought, what's he trying to do? He even tried to remonstrate, I can't remember who the teammate was, as if to say you should have been anticipating that. But even if he'd been anticipating it, there was no way he would have got to it because it was just wasn't anywhere. And then yes, I mean the kind of inverted commas penalty was hilariously embarrassing for him because of VAR. You know, pre VAR, okay, we would know that he'd mugged Liverpool off, but he had to deal with it there in front of them in a very empty stadium where it's sort of his humiliation was kind of obviously more magnified. But yeah, you're right. Henderson did say that to him, and he sort of. It was almost like, seeing it live, it was almost like, I don't want to know about this because I know, you know, I don't want to have to face the fact that I've just done that. And it's interesting because someone was talking about how good he is for a dressing room. He's a real team man, you know, with England, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just thinking, well, Henderson's obviously a big England player and that's not going to go down too well. He's from St. Helens, I think the commentator said. I didn't realise that. I thought he was sort of, not that it necessarily matters, but, you know, it was just, what are you doing on both occasions, really? But yeah, that's got to be the...
Jamie, who is the most famous player ever to have played for St. Helens Town?
Is it someone
relevant
like,
to your...
Is it someone like Steve
relevant
Highway?
To your dog?
Oh, Bert Troutman.
Bert Troutman, that's correct.
Jamie has a puppy called Bert, just for those who weren't listening to the Zoom call before we pressed record. I suppose in that moment for Cody, he's thinking... I know I haven't been touched. I understand. I could, if he said I was anticipating the contact, I would believe him, right? Because Mane is actually very clever to get his foot out of the way. But then in that moment, he's got to think, if I say no, it was a dive, I'm going to really piss off my own teammates who I have to spend the most time with and see them in a minute, like in the dressing room. So in the short term, it's better. But if he put his hands up to say, actually, that was a dive, he'd be the most... Liverpool would have to sign him, wouldn't they? If he'd done that to say, I didn't do that. Anyway, Barry, Liverpool going forward. I mean, sorry to give you another cul-de-sac, but I don't know how you... what's new to say about it? Wolves are a good side. And people keep saying, oh, Liverpool, not too sure. But they're just really good.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't play... It wasn't one of their... better performances yesterday, I didn't think, but they're really good going forward, Max. I think you might have hit on something there, but I was hugely impressed with Jordan Henderson, you know, the his balls from deep, his passing was superb. Gini Wijnaldum got a brilliant goal. They don't get as much credit, obviously, as the three lads up front. Diogo Jota didn't start yesterday. Probably would have fancied a run out again or a start against his former club. But yeah, you've stitched me up, Max. They're good going forward, Liverpool. Yeah, impressive.
More important than any of this, Wilson, why are Wolves wearing Middlesbrough's 1998 away kit with Cellnet? I mean, that is a disaster.
Well, I think that's a bit unfair on Middlesbrough's 1998 away kit with Cellnet. I mean, that's a sort of a take on the Argentina kit, right? It's sort of
yes, true.
An interesting thing when you just signed a load of Brazilians, but anyway, you know, Middlesbrough's joint thinking in those days wasn't necessarily kind of there. But at least that was stripes rather than just sort of a.
Yeah, no, it's true. I made that tweet before my laptop. It was a bit unpixelated. It went from sort of, you know, Amiga graphics to Mac after I'd done that tweet because the Wi-Fi in the other room is even worse than it is here. Anyway, Liverpool joint top with Spurs. They play each other, by the way, Wednesday week. So that's an exciting one to look out for. Who knows how both sides will approach that football match. to the London Stadium, West Ham 1, Manchester United 3. Jamie, Solskjaer, still in a job. Good news for your book, mate.
Well, I tell you, I'll have a paperback coming out in the summer, as you do. And it's going to be very easy to write the extra content because there's lots to write about this up and down thing. Yeah, who knows? I mean, I think to a certain extent you're seeing Manchester United at the moment. I mean, I don't just mean in this game, but all through the season. I was looking at some of my past match reports. So obviously the Spurs one, you know, I think I sort of, you know, when they lost 6-1, I sort of said the old line about they would struggle to give a Parks team a game, you know, on the back of that. And then, you know, they beat Newcastle, Leipzig. Who knows what's going to happen tomorrow against Leipzig? I'm due to do a presser with Ollie ahead of that. Later today, the mood will be jovial because they've just won. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. He still doesn't know what his best team is. My little pet theory is he needs to get Greenwood in that team more often than not, and that hasn't been. He so far hasn't been able to do that. I think he's really missed him. It might sound a bit odd because he's only sort of 18, 19, but he was the difference in lockdown post lockdown, the end of last season for me anyway. He's got a hat full of goals and just gave him something different. Pogba scores a worldie as he can. I don't know, Fernandes has to come on. I don't know, really. To a certain extent, it's like United post-Ferguson still. You know, they still don't really know what you're getting. But I would say it's probably, how can I say, it's all relative, but I think it's the best or the better team, strong squad they've had since Ferguson left. We can all have an argument about whether I'm right or wrong. That's just my own little theory, just because I do think it is more joined up. But a little bit like Arteta, but further down the road. I've always said that by January of this season, I know we started later, is the correct time to judge Solskjaer, because then he would have had a whole full season last season, two summer windows, and then, yeah, part of this one, basically half of it. So let's see where they are. But if you look at the table, if they win their game in hand, because they do have one, a bit like City, although they're a point ahead, I think they would go to 22 points, which is not that far off the top, which I don't know, really. But yeah, we're talking about Liverpool and City, especially Liverpool. They're like the real deal. I don't think United are particularly close to those two, to be honest.
I know United have now gone behind in five successive away games and won them all, league games. But Moyes has got a big problem with this. And for all the praise he's got, most of it totally justified, he's been back at West Ham not almost a year, just over 11 months. And they've dropped 15 points from winning positions in that time. In his two spells at West Ham put together, only twice has the result improved after his first substitution. And one of those was against Villa last Monday, when he made two changes at half-time, scored in the first minute of the second half, and then got battered for the rest of the half. So this habit of going deeper and deeper and deeper in the final 15, 20 minutes of games, and it happened at Sunderland on the very, very rare occasions when Sunderland took the lead under Moyes, or had anything to hold on to in the final minutes of the game. It's a very old-fashioned way of defending, and it doesn't work. And now, certainly towards the end of his time at Everton, there was a suggestion that fitness was an issue, that his fitness methods weren't up to the speed of other managers. So that would be, for all the West Ham start the season really well, that would be my big, big concern, that that pattern is being repeated again. Having said that, the equaliser clearly shouldn't have stood.
Yes, Tom says, should VAR be able to tell when the ball is in play? Matt says, following the assistant referee completely ignoring the ball going out of play, what's the most basic part of your job that you've ever forgotten to do? Plugging in the microphone, I guess, for me and Barry. Sarang says an interesting point. A rule recommendation, the ball going out of play will have to pitch outside the line. Otherwise, it will be considered in play. The ball being played loads more. New ridiculous techniques for corner kicks of bending the ball out to come in. Can the pod contact IFAB, please?
Well, I mean, that would make it like cricket, right? Which I think is not the worst idea. I mean, it certainly would be easier to administer. I mean, I think the thing is so frustrating about that incident on Saturday is that we're in this world of pedantry about everything. And, you know, we can detect handballs at subatomic level, and yet we can't see a ball that's gone out of play by 2 or 3 feet. My instinct was that it was out of play. I didn't see how it could possibly not have gone out of play. And yet somehow we're unable to see that when, you know, the ball can brush your forearm, dislodge your hair, and that's enough to give a penalty for.
Jonathan, is it hypocritical of you to criticise a world of pedantry?
I think that's unfair. I think my pedantry is very precisely and correctly deployed. I don't yet take a set of, I don't know, electronic scales with me to the pub to make sure I'm getting my full pint. there's a time and a place for pedantry. Unfortunately for you, inhabit the part of my life where I deploy pedantry most regularly.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two will start at the bridge. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Chelsea 3, Leeds 1. Paul, could Wilson please give us a detailed summary of the tactical masterclass given to Bielsa by Lampard?
I thought this might be a test for Lampard, and it really wasn't. But since the Southampton game, they'd gone 9 games, only letting in 2 goals. But those games have fallen into 2 categories. Games you'd expect Chelsea to win, or games against decent sides where they essentially sat back and accepted the 0-0 draw. Now, you could say the Sevilla away game in the Champions League doesn't quite fit, but you know that was sort of a game with very little riding on it. But this game where Chelsea sort of had to attack, but against a decent side, and a side that's been at its best this season when it had space to attack into, I thought might be a concern. And when Bamford scored, you thought, yeah, well, that's exactly the weakness we've seen Chelsea have, is when they do come forward, they do leave space in behind them, and their press is not good enough to stop that. But after that, they were excellent, and they probably should have won more comfortably than 3-1.
Yeah, one for the XG heads. Their expected goals tally of 4.1 was the highest for a side in a single Premier League game so far this season.
Well, I think you have Tim O'Werner to thank for that, don't you? I mean, he could have scored 4 or 5 goals. Looking at the stats for that game, actually, because Leeds can come out of 0-0 draws having had 57 shots on goal, but in this game they were restricted to 8, and afterwards Bielsa said that they really struggled with Chelsea playing the ball out from the back in that, so far as they couldn't get it from them, and that obviously was a problem, and Chelsea deserve credit for that. And it annoys me, actually, because I'm always very interested to hear what Bielsa has to say, more so than most managers. But because he speaks through a translator, TV companies tend to only give, you know, a 1 or 2 sentence soundbite, just a kind of token nod to him, which is a shame, because I would like to hear him expound on why he thinks his team lost that game and were quite unimpressive. They've been impressive in defeat this season, but they were not impressive at all in that game, in my opinion.
Jamie, where do you put Chelsea in the title mix? You have to, don't you?
Yeah, I think so, especially because of the sort of season we're in the middle of, or in, you know, at the start of. You know, it is a little bit up and down. I don't think they'll end up at the business end. I'd be surprised if they're still, you know, a serious challenger that Liverpool basically, and maybe City, because I'm not too sure about City. I have to be worried about. Am I allowed to say this? I'm going to say it anyway. I don't quite get this Bielsa thing. I actually witnessed the only thing he's ever won, apart from, you're going to say, maybe the championship, since 2000, which was the Olympic final of 2004, where his Argentina beat Paraguay, I think it was. I did that game for The Observer. Had Tevez in the team, Colaccini, people like that. I don't quite get it. Now, listen, probably because I'm uneducated, etc. Now, it's interesting what Barry says. I hear that a lot, Barry. I'd love to hear him expound on football. Why? I've never come across any of his sound bites that sound, oh, he sounds a bit interesting. Now, you know, I may well be wrong, but I'd like to be convinced on this one. Yeah, call me old-fashioned, but a guy who's not won anything major, you know, since the turn of the sort of millennia, don't know, it's a bit of a head-scratcher for me. But, you know, as I say, I'm always open to being educated.
Jonathan, we only have about half an hour left of the podcast. But...
Well, I think what's remarkable about Chelsea is how much better they've looked since they moved Kante back to the back of midfield, just playing there as a deepest lying player rather than Jorginho. And they've done that the last five games now. And I just don't know why they took something that was working so brilliantly well and decided to mess around with it. And I get that Sarri wanted his man Jorginho in there, but I don't know why Lampard bothered with it. They've looked way, way better when they've gone back to something that we knew worked and put the best player in the world in that position.
Are you not deigning the Bielsa criticism with a response?
I mean, it's such a farcical opinion. Where do you begin? I mean, it's like saying Christianity's had no impact. It's just, I mean, no individual has so conditioned how football, this modern football, is played in the last 30 years as Bielsa. Now, he has flaws in how he
wins things
in his fundamentalism, and he is so adamant he wants to play his way that perhaps has not led to the success that it might have done. But that, in its own way, I think is admirable in a certain sense, that there is a purity to what he does, and he has inspired, you know, almost all modern coaches, with the possible exception of Mourinho, have in some way taken something from Bielsa. You know, he's maybe a greater theorist than he is a coach. But if you look at what he's done with Leeds, he's taken the team that had the seventh highest wage bill in the Championship last season, taking them to win the title quite convincingly. Yeah, to start this season with. Yeah, some very eye-catching performances. And he doesn't deal in soundbites because he doesn't deal in soundbites. He doesn't play the media game. Why would he? He's not David Cameron. He's Marcelo Bielsa. He deals in long, complicated sentences because his thinking on football is long and complicated.
We should do a whole pod on this at some point. West Brom 1, Crystal Palace 5. Stephen says, did Barry realise West Brom existed this weekend? Just asking because the Palace attack showed that the West Brom defence didn't realise that they existed themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite the hiding. I think I watched 6.5 games in 30 hours between Saturday and Sunday. This, I will confess, I was kind of making Sunday roast and keeping tabs on it. But it was very impressive performance by Palace, but West Brom pretty much undone by a red card, which I thought was unfair. I can understand why it was given, and this is where we are now. We are all to blame for the fact that Pereira got that red card, and it's a sad state of affairs, really. But West Brom are not very good. Crystal Palace are good at times. I was hugely impressed with Eberizi Eze. He was brilliant. He's so graceful on the ball. I don't know. It's almost like he's floating rather than running when he's on the ball. And he has great understanding with his fellow forward players. And hats off to Crystal Palace.
Sheffield United 1, Leicester City 2. A stat of the day from producer Joel. Jamie Vardy has scored in 5 consecutive away Premier League games in Yorkshire. Only the third player to achieve that after Wayne Rooney and Harry Kane. Jamie, do you think John Egan has to foul Vardy as he's going through there?
Yes, yeah. Get sent off, basically. I mean, you know, I think he's already been sent off once this season, but, you know, you just have to do it and just you know, give your team a chance. I don't think anyone's going to be cheesed off with him, especially because it's basically the end of the match. But obviously, I think we've all seen the shot of Wilder watching this unfold from some sort of behind him. I saw quite a bit of Sheffield United, even though it's not my normal beat, you know, last season, and they look very good at time, like, you know, the real deal sort of thing for that sort of, for what you'd expect them to hopefully be able to produce. So, I don't know. But yeah, he should just give him the old, whatever you want to call it, 1-2 and bring him down, and then, you know, hopefully the penalty save, basically.
Oh, it wouldn't even be in the box, would it? I mean, that was the point. You could do it outside.
Yeah, sorry,
the box,
yeah, the free
then,
kick, yeah.
Yeah, you know. And then it's a one-match ban. Jonathan says...
Well, it would be a two-match ban because it would have been his second red card of the season.
Oh, hello.
Okay. Jonathan says, did that corner flag go down too easily under the challenge of Jamie Vardy? Quite incredible to see it sort of fly into splinters, wasn't it? What does Sheffield United do, Jonathan? Stick with Chris Wilder? 1 point after 11, I think, is the worst ever Premier League start.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've got to, because I don't even think they're playing that badly, are they? They're just not scoring goals. I mean, certainly the game against West Brom last week, they should have won that. I thought they pretty much held their own against Leicester. So, yeah, I'm not really sure what purpose is served by sacking him now, because you sort of suspect whoever comes in, they're not going to stay up. And Wilder is part of a greater project that has been very successful. So... I know the way of football is you know, when the gods are angry, you offer a blood sacrifice. But yeah, I think patience is the thing they should do. But it's easy to say that when I'm not a Sheffield United fan and watching from the outside. But I don't actually think they've been that bad.
No, I don't. I don't disagree with that, to be honest. Manchester City 2, Fulham 0. Barry, on Thursday, you sat back laconically and announced that you thought Fulham would get something from this game.
I did, and. Because I was so hugely impressed with their performance against Leicester, and they didn't play particularly badly. Fulham's problem is that they concede too many really early goals. In 6 of their Premier League games this season, they've conceded inside the first 8 minutes, and they've lost all 6 of those games. And it seems to smack of... just sloppiness and lack of concentration. Now, obviously, as Scott Parker said, there's no shame in going to the Etihad and losing 2-0. But the 2 goals they conceded were quite avoidable, in my opinion. So, obviously, my prediction was wrong, but I don't think it was a ridiculous prediction. And the evidence of that game would suggest it wasn't ridiculous. Fulham played quite well. Obviously, Man City... Sorry, go on.
I thought you were going to say, my prediction was wrong, but I stick to it. And I still think they'll get something from this game. For the first time in 416 games, a manager in the top 5 European leagues... didn't use a single substitute, Pep not bringing anyone on, which is quite interesting given how comfortable they were, Jamie. Where do you assess where Manchester City are at the moment?
Yeah, so I was obviously at this game, and I'll tell you what's interesting. Laporte seems to have demoted too strong, but having been kind of a massive reason why their already threadbare defence just wasn't any good last season because of his injuries, he's gone from being that important to sort of, yeah, being benched again. And he basically admitted... he didn't name him, but he did say the mistakes we'd made against Liverpool, Spurs, and he named one other match, Leicester, previously. We just cannot have that from centre-backs. And, you know, John Stones is in there at the moment. Now, John Stones nearly scored a ridiculous own goal. I don't know if you know the moment Amin Edison came out. And instead of just looking up to see where his goalkeeper was, he sort of passed behind him kind of thing. And, you know, because we're there, it's empty, you can really sort of hear Guardiola's reaction. He wasn't happy at all. Where do I assess them? It's an interesting one, this. I think he's done a lot better. I think he's probably a lot happier than he thought he would be with the sort of squad, how it's developing this season. Ferran Torres has been a massive bonus because I was thinking, how can you replace Leroy Sané? And obviously he's not the same kind of player, but in terms of what he's getting from him, probably as good, as sort of productive. I mean, I was going to say they look a bit vulnerable in defence, but to be honest, which team doesn't look vulnerable in defence if you've got a good attacker? Because, you know, that's the nature of the game. Kyle Walker's playing well. There's still a bit of an issue at left back because Mendy, you know, he's fit at the moment. But I don't know. I give him more of a chance than I did a month ago. I thought they were in a bit of trouble, maybe getting top four, which might sound a bit ridiculous now. But as I said earlier, I'm still interested to see whether they are challenging seriously by the end of it. But, you know, De Bruyne, you know, you talk about cul-de-sac. What else can you say about him? Not only is he unbelievably, you know, beautifully talented and, you know, sublime passer vision, but he's just a proper, it's like a cruiserweight or something. Yeah, people bounce off him. He just bosses games like there isn't anyone else around, whatever cliche you want to use. And he said afterwards, Guardiola, actually, I'll just say this. He said, yeah, he's the epitome of a modern footballer. Not only does he do all, you know, the lovely stuff, but he really does stuff for the team. So, you know, as basically, you know, I think he is the captain. Is he actually the captain? Well, when Fernandinho doesn't play, he's basically the captain. You know, he's a great person to be, you know, the sort of leader, because he just, you know, he bosses it for them.
Burnley 1, Everton 1. One win in 7 now for Everton. What does this mean, Barry? Does it mean, despite all that early season excitement, they're just destined for 7th?
Probably. It is quite the turnaround. I mean, I've noticed people are starting to grumble about James Rodriguez, who started brilliantly in the Premier League, hasn't been playing particularly well of late. Did notice, actually, before the game, he was blowing into his hands repeatedly. Didn't look hugely as if, you know, a cold early December afternoon at Turf Moor was quite what he was dreaming of when he moved to Everton. Now, call me a lazy cliche merchant, but yeah, he didn't go so far as to wear gloves, so I don't know. He hasn't been playing well. And the thing is, if he's not contributing going forward, he might as well not be there, because he contributes nothing in defence, but that's something he can get away with when he's playing well and scoring and assisting. But it was a game that could have gone either way, I suppose. But yeah, my first note on this game is James did not like the cold at Turf Moor. I suppose the other thing in that game is, two things. Fabian Delph going off, I think, helped Everton because they had a lot more width when, who was it came on for him? Andre Gomes, who I think is a terrific player, and Gareth Southgate was there. And Nick Pope and Jordan Pickford both played exceptionally well. So probably wasn't much of a help to him.
Thank you, Barry. Worth pointing out now for the listener that I did record it and my microphone was working. And then suddenly, perhaps it was just the discussion of how cold James Rodriguez was, but my recording stopped working. It says it's working now. So hopefully that wasn't enough to turn you off, and we'll do the last bit and part 3 with my voice sounding like it's recorded in a professional environment. Hopefully the other 3 of you sound better than I have for the pod so far. We'll be back in a sec. Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly. You will have almost certainly seen the footage from the new Den where Millwall fans booed their own players and the Derby players who were taking the knee before kickoff of that game. Jacob Steinberg tweeting, "You wait 9 months to go to a football match and the first thing you do is boo players taking a knee. How awful. do you have to be to do that? Racism alive and well in English football. Marlon Romeo, a Millwall defender, a London-born black player who's represented Antigua and Barbuda, said, "What they've done is booed and condemned a peaceful gesture which was put in place to highlight combat and stop any discriminatory behaviour and racism. That's it. That's all that gesture is. But in society, there's a problem, and that problem is racism." My Two Cents got in touch with us and said, "Is there any way you and the Football Weekly team could give as little time as possible to the Millwall disgrace? Most people are on board with the BLM movement, and the small minority shouldn't be getting airtime, as it just creates more division. It could be more effective."
Hi, Football Weekly fans. Excuse the echoey voice note. I'm at the homeless shelter that I work at every week, but I don't like to talk about it. We need to reference Millwall's statement. They said that the club had been left dismayed and saddened and admitted the booing had completely overshadowed the return of supporters to their home ground for the first time in 9 months. The impact of such incidents is felt not just by the players and management, but also by those who work throughout the club and in its academy and community trust, where so many staff and volunteers continue passionate endeavours to enhance Millwall's reputation day after day, year after year. Over the coming days, the club academy and community trust staff will meet with Kick It Out and representatives from other appropriate bodies in an attempt to use Saturday's events as a catalyst for more rapid solutions, which have an impact both in the short and long term. Further comment will be made once these meetings and discussions are concluded. Back to the pod.
Barry, your thoughts?
No, I think it's worth discussing because Millwall fans have had plenty to say about it on social media and in statements through their supporters club over the weekend. Millwall fans did this to get a reaction. Now that they're getting a reaction, they're all clutching their pearls like Victorian ladies in need of the smelling salts. The fact of the matter is that the players put out, they knew this was coming. They put out a statement before the day before the game saying that any gesture they made was not affiliated to any political movement, specifically Black Lives Matter, capital B, capital L, capital M. And it was purely a gesture to raise awareness of discrimination. So people who booed that gesture in that knowledge were clearly voicing their displeasure against this gesture, against discrimination, which means they are racist. Now, Millwall fans have since, they would have us believe that their booing is incredibly nuanced booing and that we should be able to discern from the pitch of that jeering that they're actually against an organisation that's anti-family, anti-law and order and Marxist. Who knew that these Millwall fans had such a strident opinions about these things? And they claim also they're booing the divisive and woke politics of football. They might have a point if, as I say, the players hadn't specifically stressed before the game that any gesture they made was nothing to do with that. And I have a big problem with Millwall fans, middle-aged, many of them white Millwall fans, telling black people what they should or should not be or what they should or should not find racist. Marlon Romeo was clearly very, very hurt by the reaction. And I'd be honest, some years ago I was arrogant enough to presume that I knew what black people should or should not find racist. I was wrong. I've learned the error of my ways, and hopefully these guys will too, but their reaction on Twitter would suggest they won't. And the statement put out by the Millwall Supporters Club was laughable. They said they waited over 24 hours to put it out because they wanted it to be considered and they wanted to consult as many people as possible. I shudder to think how bad it would have been if they'd scribbled it on the back of a cigarette box straight after the game. They started off by saying they fervently believed that the reaction to this gesture wasn't racist, and then went on to explain that, oh, actually, maybe it was racist. They quoted Les Ferdinand, possibly because they couldn't find anyone at their own club who might give some semblance of backing to what they were trying to do, because Les Ferdinand made a decision recently that QPR would no longer take the knee. That doesn't mean that Les Ferdinand has been booing other teams for taking the knee.
Yeah, Leon Mann tweeted, "The garbage I've read on here since the booing of taking a knee. It is not similar to Les Ferdinand's stance. He only disagreed with only taking this symbolic action without real action. And the symbolic action is not supporting a political party. Be anti-racist. Don't boo. What do you think should happen, Jonathan? Should the players walk off the pitch? Should Millwall not be allowed to have fans back? They've got a game on Tuesday night, I think.
Yeah, I mean, as a sort of general principle, I think players walk off a pitch is not a great idea just because it can be manipulated in so many ways. That said, I couldn't blame a player who was so upset by that they didn't want to play on. I think it's probably for individuals to decide or for the teams themselves to decide. There's a huge problem here for both Millwall and the football authorities because, appalling as this is, no crime has been committed. So I'm not really sure what steps you can take. Presumably Millwall would have the right as a club to cancel season tickets and refund them or to close the ground again. I'm not really sure of the logistics of doing that or whether they would be open to legal action. And I don't know. I mean, over the years, I've spoken to loads of people at Millwall talking about how they're trying to rectify things among their fan base. And I mean, I remember back in, which year would it have been, 2013, when Millwall played in the FA Cup semi-final against Wigan. And you may remember, there was fighting in the stand and there was people openly taking cocaine in the stands. But there was also, 3 hours before that game, I was on the tube up to Wembley, and at Finchley Road, suddenly, the carriage I was on was absolutely, it had gone from being very quiet to being absolutely rammed. And trying to work out what was going on, and it became apparent, both from talking to people and then when I got off at Wembley Park, that there was a load of Millwall fans that got on the next carriage down and had begun racially abusing people. And so they'd all left that carriage and come into the carriage I was in. So, I mean, this is an ongoing problem. And, Millwall clearly have, while they're not the only club with problems, they clearly have a very, very serious problem. And nothing they do seems to put it right. So, I don't have an easy answer.
There's a word for people who have a problem with gestures promoting racial equality. If you have a problem with that, you are a racist. And no amount of hiding behind spurious connections to the Black Lives Matter makes you any less of a racist.
I think on that point, I think that's why it was quite a smart move and quite an important thing for both the Premier League and the EFL to detach themselves from Black Lives Matter as a movement. Because if you're going to have your own anti-discriminatory gesture if you're going to have taken the knee, I think as a football authority, you need it to be something you can control. That it's not somebody else setting the message that you can't control. So the fact that the slogan in the Premier League has changed to No Room for Racism, in the EFL to Not Today or Any Day, to sort of say, while our goals are not entirely dissimilar to Black Lives Matter, we are not part of that very broad movement. I think, even without the Millwall player statement, that totally undermines any argument that this was a response or this was an expression of opposition to BLM.
Can I suggest something, maybe? Because tickets or attendance is so, I'm going to say precious at the moment because not everyone's being let in, why don't they just have a rule? If you do that, you're not coming back in and we'll try the next sort of people who are waiting to watch Millwall games. And if you can behave yourself and be, basically nice people, which really, shouldn't be that difficult, then you're allowed the privilege of watching these games, which are difficult to see at the moment. I mean, it's just, I don't know, without wanting to sound a little bit cheesy, people who do that are kind of lost. They have no idea of what is right or wrong, really. And Barry's right what he's saying, that they are racist. What? I mean, I don't know. I'm sure like lots of people listening, you gents as well, some of you anyway. I've got two children. One's 9, one's 7. And my 9-year-old, he's a lad, about a year, maybe 2 years ago, he started to realise that racism existed. That was heartbreaking. To have to sort of explain to him that someone else, just because they've got a different colour of skin is somehow viewed by some idiots that, I don't know, whatever, you know, you understand where I'm going with this. It's just heartbreaking. It really is. And you see that, you just feel, oh. You know, on one hand, it's not that big a surprise, even though obviously it shouldn't be happening because it's like, oh, Christ.
I agree.
I don't know, why don't they just ban them?
Yeah, look, I agree that they're lost. And I think that's what's so hard, isn't it? And I've seen, Barry, you know, you sort of trying to reason with people on social media. And I've just been muting because I don't know what to do or to say. Like, and if you say you're a racist, that certainly doesn't make somebody go, oh, maybe I am, I'll have a think about this. I don't, but then reasoning doesn't work, you know, and it's like on a football podcast, we're not going to solve it. We've talked about it before, you know, I don't know what the solution is. I sort of feel if Millwall as a club came out and said, if they boo, we're going to walk off the pitch and the Oppo get the result because that's more important than our result. That would be a very difficult step for them to take because it's their job, right? And it's what they do. And I wouldn't expect them to do it, but that might make the fans think. It might not. I don't know.
I don't think it would, to be honest.
Yeah, maybe.
I've a bit of a soft spot for Millwall. I've been to the Den on numerous occasions because it's probably the handiest ground for me to get to from where I live, and it can be a very unpleasant place to go, but then so can many other football grounds. But you are not going to convince those who firmly believe that they're fighting some, you know, the people who defaced the statue of Winston Churchill and the people who tried to, you know, vandalize the cenotaph, and the people who, let's not forget, one of the most iconic photographs of the year, one of the people who rescued an unconscious Millwall fan and carried him over his shoulder out of a very dangerous situation. You know, Millwall fans might do well to think about that. But even if you have no time for the players taking a knee, and I'll be honest, it has occurred to me that maybe it's taken its course, and occasionally when Match of the Day insist on showing it, I sometimes am inclined to roll my eyes because what is the point of this? I'm sort of in the Les Ferdinand camp. Just observe it. It takes 4 or 5 seconds. I've observed minute silences for people who have died who I had no time for. You know, I don't feel the need to boo all the way through it. So, you know, it's just basic. Have a bit of respect.
Now, EFL clubs have collectively agreed to accept the Premier League's offer of a $50 million bailout for teams in League One and League Two. The Premier League's offer currently includes unconditional funding, a split between loans and grants totaling £50 million to clubs in the lower two divisions. Championship teams have been invited by the Premier League to apply for hardship funds on a case-by-case basis. An estimated 10 clubs in League One and League Two are struggling to make payroll in November, which sort of made this vitally important. The EFL said the EFL believes that today represents a significant step forward and is hopeful that a final agreement on the short-term rescue package across all three divisions can be reached imminently, which will provide much-needed support, clarity and certainty for all EFL clubs at a time when they need it most. Jonathan, is this enough money? Is this this seems like a good thing. Is it enough? Does it depend on what the Premier League expect back?
Well, the whole point is that they really shouldn't have to. I mean, I guess there's two separate issues here. One is that the finances of football have been, you know, disgracefully iniquitous for years, and so some kind of redress on that, I guess, was probably required. But football is the only industry where the richer companies are having to bail out the poorer companies. Everybody else getting bailed out by the government. I'm not really sure why football is regarded as something different. So is it enough? I mean, it's never going to be enough, is it? I mean, for instance, I know that Sunderland are losing roughly £1 million a month at the minute, and the return of fans, I mean, Sunderland's in Tier 3, so that's not imminent. But when fans are back, that actually just costs money because season tickets have already been sold, so it'd be season ticket holders coming in, and obviously they have to pay for security and stewarding and all that. So you know, it's not the financial situation is going to improve dramatically in the next 3 or 4 months. So, what are you meant to do when you're a business when you have no income? And football seems to be the only business where the richer people are supposed to bail out the poor. I mean, we're not seeing big banks being asked to bail out smaller banks or big law companies bailing out, you know, street corner solicitors. But for whatever reason, that's the way the government's decided to play it.
Jonathan, can you tell us a bit, please, about Viktor Ponedelnik? Have I pronounced that correctly?
Yeah, Ponedelnik, yeah, which means Wednesday in Russian. His name is Viktor Wednesday. He died over the weekend, aged, I think, 83. And he scored the winner in the first ever European Championship final, which the Soviet Union won. And he was the last member of that side to survive. So a chapter was closed. And I assume that they would have tried to use him at the Euros in some kind of promotional capacity, had that been possible. But obviously that will not now happen.
I don't know if you saw this, Barry, in Stuttgart's game. A player called Silas Wamangituka scored a goal. Basically, he nicked the ball. It was a bad back pass or a chest back to the keeper. He got in front of it and then just wandered up slowly to the goal line and then just stood there and waited and waited and waited. So the goalkeeper had to run back and do the thing. He didn't get on his hands and knees to head it, which is a bit of a shame, and then booted it in. And he got booked for unsportsmanlike conduct, which is ridiculous.
I did see it. I wasn't aware he'd been booked, but I noticed one of the opposing players did take him to task over showboating. What's the offence? Unsportsmanlike behaviour?
I guess ungentlemanly conduct, perhaps.
Okay. Well, you know. He could have been more ostentatious about it, I think.
More good news for producer Joel on his three French greats, Napoleon, Marie Antoinette and Picasso. Many people got in touch, including Jonathan Wilson. Colin the Sausage below the line. Marie Antoinette wasn't much more French than Picasso. She was Austrian.
Well, okay, to be fair, though, I think she probably did become French. Right. At the point at which she married Louis. Because there's that scene in the film, which I think is apocryphal, where when she crosses the border, when she goes into France, she has to discard all her possessions, take off all her clothes and put on French clothing. So I think that probably is a symbolic becoming French. That said, Napoleon is French in only the very loosest definition of the term. Given that he was his family was Italian. He was born in Corsica, which had been run by Genoa for a long, long time. They finally got independence from Genoa and then were annexed by France just a few months before he was born. But they weren't formally made part of France until the revolution, 1789. So I'd say a naught, and if we're being very generous, two halves.
TJ says, as an Ohioan, check that, a Northeast Ohioan, I'm more than okay with more Ohio bashing on the pod. Bash Cleveland, on the other hand, and he says there'll be problems. Joe says the correspondent from Ohio is almost certainly a graduate of Ohio State. Only alumni insist on calling it the Ohio State University, and they are almost universally insufferable, at least to these Hoosier ears, he says. And Chairman Kev says, on the subject of Ohio, I do have a Leeds supporting friend who lives there. Upon discussing Ohio and its sports teams one day, FC Cincinnati came up in our conversation. Whilst reading their Wikipedia page, I discovered not only are FC Cincinnati managed by Yap Stam, but Arsenal legend Justin Hoyt has been playing there since 2017. This can be added to the list of Ohio things to brag about. Also, Charles Manson and Don King are from Ohio. The list goes on. And finally, on the search for Carly Rae Jepsen, a listener has got in touch with an email address for someone close to her. So you never know. We may get permission from Carly Rae. Yes, Ben?
Or you may get arrested issued with an injunction.
One of the two. Anyway, that'll do for today's pod. Jamie, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Cheers.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Wednesday, hopefully, with the whole pod recorded well and in quality. It's my fault this time.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.